fact that we are sovereign people. Not only are we sovereign, but your very Constitution of the United States was copied from my Constitution of the Iroquois Confederacy. But you have, I don't say you, but the United States government has greatly misused it. Not only that, but a lot of people don't realize the first Articles of Confederation that the colonists had to sever their ties with England was copied word for word from the Iroquois Confederacy. My grandmother, when she was alive, often used to tell me that one day the Indian would come back in their own, and we would truly be sovereign. Sovereignty is earned. Sovereignty is taken. It's true, the United States government doesn't like to hear this talk. But the United States government is an infant government, not even 200 years old. And according to Indian prophecies across this land, they will not see their 200th birthday if they don't straighten up. There are some things I'd like to tell you pertaining to Wounded Knee. Spiritually and in every other way, I have backed Wounded Knee. It represented to us the fulfillment of an Iroquois prophecy that one day our people, the choice here, the young people, would stand up and begin to speak from the heart. And it's true that it took the spiritual leaders to calm down certain of our feelings, feelings which nobody can blame us for having, the so-called militant feelings. But let me tell you, the Constitution of the United States in Article 6, Section 2 clearly defines the power and authority of treaties in this way. It says, this Constitution and the laws of every state which shall be bound thereby, and anything in this Constitution or any laws pertaining to the United States is null and void. And you know that as well as I do. Also, I might remind you as an attorney of obligations. If you know that somebody is committing a crime as an officer of the court, it certainly is your duty to try to bring justice in this case. And anything short of that would be aiding and abetting. Also, I'd like to say that we Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy have a suit against the Canadian government representing several billion dollars for violation of the Haldimand Treaty of 1794. We went across to The Hague, and our suit remains there as a result of our people taking the initiative to force this sovereignty in the recognition of our treaties made between Great Britain and not Canada, but Canada, who is violating it. The United States Indian Claims Commission was established immediately because they're afraid of this money. The only way they hurt a white man is to hit him in a pocketbook. I'm not so much for killing anybody, because I believe that we were all created by the same people, by the same creator. We are brothers and sisters. But somewhere back along the line, someone has lied, someone has violated our rights, and we are going to get those rights back. A lot of people do not realize it, but I recognize one of my friends is walking, one of my brothers is walking into this room by the dog park. Now I'm going to tell you people something. When Wounded Knee was in the darkest hour, we went to New York to back the Wounded Knee situation up. We were told that the troops were going to come in and take the Indians out of Wounded Knee by force. We went and presented a petition to the United Nations, and the petition was accepted to set aside immediately a fact-finding team that would go into Wounded Knee. Within 24 hours after this petition was accepted, the Wounded Knee thing was over. And what I suspect is when the government, after we notified the U.S. mission to the U.N., when the government notified Wounded Knee back again, even though they had said that there'll be no more negotiations and stop, get out of Wounded Knee, they suddenly done an about face, promised them the moon, which they don't own. I'd like to tell you also that we have treaties with the United States ever made after getting its so-called independence from England. And the words of that treaty are the boundary line separating the countries of the United States and the Six Nations shall be as follows. It gives an enormous boundary line, and at the bottom of that article it reads, and the United States shall never claim the same, nor disturb the Seneca Nation, nor any of the Six Nations, for as long as the grass grows green, and the rivers run free, and the sun sets in the west. George Washington put his signature on this treaty, and we have one of the original copies with his signature in quill. That certainly is sovereignty. And I don't care what department of government was ever set up after. What other department of thievery stepped in there? They did not keep our sovereignty from us. We will assert it. We do not care what the interpretation of the federal statutes are. They are all wrong. Watergate is opening the door. And will you mark my words? We Indian people have our day coming. And we will be heard, but we will stand again strong in sovereignty. Thank you very much.
Gets to spend money, or it's not a battle of who gets a job or something like that. It's a battle of survival. It's a battle of identity. It's a battle of pride. And it's a battle of the right to be a human being. So let's think about these things. Let's go home and let's start exercising that sovereignty. Let's do something about it. Thank you.
Oh! that is behind us. Many things are behind us. Pray God is behind us. As is the Eagle River decision behind us. So I'm not here to, in any sense, complain. I think that we are in the process of evolving concepts vital to the continuity of the American Indian people. It seems to me that the Indians who have lived in a constant crisis since our friend John Cabot sailed down the Virginia coast and announced that the King of England owned all of North America, or for example, we have been confronted, those of us who believe in a human being have been confronted with a constant crisis, the crisis of survival. I would like to cut through the legalisms because I don't believe that legalisms mean very much. I am convinced that when the Eagle decision came down, the declaration that the national government would be subjected to state courts for adjudicating its rights, it took no great genius to know that the next step would be the seizure of the Indian rights to the use of water by the legal devices that have so frequently been used in the destruction of Indian properties. What does it mean to the average man, woman, and child in this room and on the reservations? It means this, that if you're subjected to state control, the local state politician, county politician, district politician, invariably non-Indian, will control your land, they'll control your water, they'll control your destiny, and in the ultimate, in my view, they'll control the ultimate occupation. I'm not a Cassandra. I'm not standing here saying that there is no remedy. I am saying that you are confronted with controls from outside of the reservation. That's what Aikens means. That's what Eagle River means. It means that your homes and your abiding places, which I don't know of a single reservation that is not vitally concerned with its water rights, your lives are going to be controlled hereafter by the man in the county courthouse, by the water master appointed by a local judge. He will control the opening and closing of your head gates. He'll control reading how much land you can use, because the amount of land that you're going to use is going to be controlled by the water to a very marked degree. It's a tragic thing. It's a shameful thing. But I have never accomplished anything in this veil of tears, whatever it was that I accomplished, by standing and wringing my hands. We made up our minds when Eagle River came down that it was time for the Indian people to, those who were listening to the ominous notes of Eagle River. We began then to plan. One of the leaders that plan with is my very close friend Jim, who passed away, but we have to go on without him. And we are in the position of conquering. And I hope we conquer vigorously the activities of those who have planned the Eagle River case, who have planned the Aikens case, who have sought to deny you the relief in the trustees' court, that is the federal court, who have sought to deny you the right to have a federal man working with you and indeed under your direction. These are the things that we're fighting for. And when we met in the last few weeks, not even a few weeks, over in Stowe about 10 days ago in Spokane, as we were reported to you. And there we made the declaration, the Indians made the declaration, that they would control their rights to the use of water, their natural resources, and that they would decide how the waters on their reservation, and as a consequence, how their land within the reservations would be governed, and how and the means pursuant to which those lands and waters would be governed. I think the most striking thing that came out of the meetings with the Stowe, the 19 tribes over on the Puget Sound, and the many, many tribes that met in Spokane, the most important thing that emerged was a declaration that the Indians are the owners of their lands and their rights to the use of water, and that under their inherent sovereignty, they were going to control those lands and rights to the use of water, always acting in conjunction with the trustee United States of America, which under the Constitution is absolutely bound to act solely for the benefit of the Indian people. Now, the means that were adopted to take care of the crisis that is facing these Indian people by these legalisms of the Eagle River and Aiken's case were this. It has been proposed, and I hope the Indian tribes will act on the proposal, that they proclaim that hereafter that no one will use any water on the reservation without a permit from the tribal council. Now that means this, that a non-Indian on the reservation will have to come to the tribe or the tribe's delegated agent and say, may we use some water? That is a courageous action to be taken by the tribe. But pray God to do it. Pray God to do it, because if you do not, your land and your lives and your economy will pass totally out of your control. And they will pass out of the control of the trustee United States of America. They will pass, as I said, to the courthouse politician who will tell you Indian people how to live. And that is the crisis that is confronting you. And it is the hope and prayer of those of us who have spent our lives with Indian people that you will say, yes, we are sovereigns. Yesterday I was working with the Camp Fort McDowell people, and I didn't hear a statement that Indian tribal sovereignty is some kind of a myth. It's in the papers. I wish I had been here, because there is no myth about your sovereignty. The fact that it has been suppressed, your right to rule yourselves, the right to rule your reservations, is no myth. You have an inherent tribal sovereignty dating back long before the United States of America was ever created. And it has that tremendous dignity. Now it is the dignity, the sovereignty, that you people pray God will invoke when you say, we are going to control our own land and our own waters, and we are going to tell the non-Indian intruders upon our reservation that they can use water if we say you may use water for a while. But those waters were reserved for you, for a viable community of Indian people on the reservation in perpetuity. So you have two things. You have your Indian sovereignty of the highest dignity under the Constitution of the United States of America, and that Constitution guarantees you that inherent sovereignty. And in the exercise of that sovereignty, you can protect yourselves. You can protect yourselves by saying, our lands have been intruded upon, and our rights have been seized by non-Indians, but we are going to exercise our full power. Don't anybody tell you that's a myth. We know. We heard yesterday and one others talking about it. They have the power. The Indians have the power. And praise God that the United States of America has the courage to back up you Indians in this fight for life. Thank you very much. I think that when this resolution was adopted, it wasn't directed to the executive branch of the federal government. It was directed naturally to the President of the United States primarily. But under the statutes that exist, the principal agent of the United States of America trustee is the Secretary of the Interior. Congress has placed in the Secretary of the Interior the responsibility to perform as a trustee. I agree with you totally, however, that the sovereign nation, that is, for example, the Colville tribe, the Yakima tribe, the Nez Perce, acting as sovereign is vis-a-vis the President of the United States of America, the sovereign. I agree with you totally. It is the basis of the functions. And I'm glad that Brad Patterson is here because he is representing the President. So this is really directed to the President, as you said. But we do call upon the Secretary of the Interior to perform. Does that cover the point? If you'd like to have it spelled out more, let's put it that way. To the President of the United States of America, it suits me. I think it would be a very good idea. There would be no basis for such a conclusion. It's a very simple way, and with all respect to the United States Attorney, to avoid a very serious conflict. But I think the law is with you as a sovereign in adopting rules and regulations to control both Indians and non-Indians on the use of those properties. I don't believe the Northwest Ordinance has one cockeyed thing to do with it. Say this, and you and I have talked about this before. I'm convinced that based upon our in-depth research with you on the issue of where your title resides, it is my view that title to those properties, the full equitable title, resides with the Kachans. I think the All-American Canal, a tremendous canal, it's a 1,500-foot right-of-way right across the reservation, is subject to the kind of regulations that we are speaking about. I'm not trying to avoid a specific answer because I have said to you, and I hope this afternoon you and I will work it out, working with Reed Chambers and others, that this matter will be squarely presented to the Secretary of the Interior. And I think it will be the responsibility of the Secretary of the Interior, and pray God he agrees with my position, that is a tremendous trespass upon your land because those lands still belong to you. And that your sovereign power, I wouldn't suggest that we try and move the All-American Canal, but I would suggest that your sovereignty is extant. It has not been in any way diminished. And I think what we ought to do is present the entire matter, as you and I have talked, and work out the kind of title controls that have to be recognized in your tribal council and the English chairman. I'm not trying to avoid a specific answer on that. I am saying that what we are endeavoring to do now is to exercise your title and your sovereignty, you are, over those properties, and I think it's a very proper demand in your part. Now, Elmer, does
that from?
Mr. Peter, Randy Couche, Northern Wisconsin, Chippewa, Lakota Ray Tribe. In your opinion, Mr. Peter, we went into this issue, and it was my opinion, I'll repeat it, it is my opinion that under the circumstances prevailing today, the Federal Fire Commission does not have jurisdiction over the area that is part of your reservation. That's the first answer. Now, there are people that disagree with me, as you well know, but and it's rather broken my spirit, as you can observe. The thing that I am saying to you is that I deny that under the circumstances that prevail, that the Federal Fire Commission has jurisdiction over that area. It is no longer, let's face it, a situation that prevailed a half century ago. And it is my view, and I sincerely hope, that we will press forward on the denial of the Federal Fire Commission is there under the law as it exists. And if that is true, then your full sovereignty can be exercised. I feel about going in and taking over those properties. Some of you guys might get shot up. What I would urge you to do, though, is to press on this question. Well, how is the Federal Fire Commission going to regulate our property for another half century? Let's fight it along that line. Is that okay? That's what I like.
Bill Fair.
Knowledge. Make it out a little easier for
me. Up ago.
Like a big knowledge.
Don't call on that. I have a
As you know, I recently became involved in San Carlos Apache Tribe. And very recently, in a matter of days, it's come to my attention that the San Carlos Apache Tribe cannot exercise regulatory powers over the fishing rights and fishing permits in San Carlos Lake. Is there anything in the authorizing legislation for the San Carlos Irrigation Project, creation of San Carlos Lake, which gives to the federal government, or gave to the federal government, full regulatory power over the waters of the lake, which apparently the federal government in turn has turned over to the state. The situation as it stands right now, you have a very, very large lake in the middle of the reservation.
That's Cooley, correct?
That's the Cooley Dam. That's right. And the state derives a tremendous amount of income over the issuance of fishing permits on the lake. My first reaction to this when I found out about it was, why hasn't the tribe issued fishing permits on the lake and regulated it themselves? The answer is that they have been informed by the federal government and the state that those powers were granted away by the tribe in the creation of the San Carlos Irrigation Project negotiations therefrom. Now, do you know of anything in that authorizing legislation to do that?
I really don't, Bill. When you were asking me, and my mind ran back, I think, to the 1924 Act. I think the first two or three lines of that 1924 Act said it was the project was going to be built primarily for the benefit of the Indians on the reservation, the King of Maricopa, isn't that right? And I would certainly start out with the concept that it didn't intend to denigrate the sovereignty or the power to regulate or operate on that way. Now, I would want to sit down with you and talk this thing through a little more. But basically, knowing the history of that act, and it's an amazing history when you stop and think what happened to the Indians under it. The whole concept of that act was that it was going to be for the benefit of the Indian people. And I would certainly adhere to that, and if there had been some kind of an action by the tribe to abandon its property rights, to abandon its sovereignty, let's re-examine it. I don't believe that one tribal council can denigrate the dignity of the sovereignty or the dignity of the title, then you do. And I think we should start there, don't you?
I agree.
I'd like to start there, but I do know the thrust of that act was for the benefit of the Indians and not for the people who are benefiting today. One of the things that I've cried about for too many years, as you all know.
Floyd Meads.
Thank you very much, Bob. President Lee Cook, I see George Lavada is still around and still heralding the events that are to come. He's kind of like the morning news, you know, always with us. Good to see you, George. First, I'd like to express my appreciation at being invited to be here. I should tell you that I had a lesson yesterday and today. I never realized that Indian power had assumed the dimensions it had. Until last night, I realized that Indians had taken over TWA Airlines. Because I found that when I started to board TWA Flight 407, that it was running on Indian time. It was 1 hour. It was 1 hour and 46 minutes late, which caused me to miss my flight in Kansas City or in St. Louis, and therefore I didn't even get off the ground in Washington, D.C. I was to be here last night to have more time with you. I realized, though, that it's better to have TWA in Indian hands than it was that I'd be here on top. I have today a written speech. I don't often speak from written speeches because I'm a little bit apprehensive about them. But today I wanted to say some specific things, and so I have a written speech. But let me tell you about my apprehension first. We hadn't been in Congress very long when one of my colleagues discovered that he wasn't the greatest public speaker in the world, and so he cast about for some method to improve his image. He finally hired a brilliant young journalism student from the University of Washington School of Journalism, and the young student began to write speeches for my colleague, and sure enough, his image began to improve. He became known as a good speaker in his own congressional district, in his own state, and ultimately in the entire United States. And after about 3 years, he was sitting in his office one day, and his speechwriter, Joe, came in and said, "Look, boss," he said, "I've been with you for 3 years now. I think I've done a reasonably commendable job. I haven't had a raise since I've been with you, and I'd like a raise." My colleague looked at Joe, his speechwriter, and he says, "Look, Joe," he said, "you were overpaid when you started working with me, and you really haven't caught up yet. No, you can't have a raise." Of course, Joe was very much taken aback, but he didn't say anything. He just went back to his cubbyhole. And about 2 weeks from that time, my colleague dashed into the office and said, "Joe," he says, "I've got this very important speech to give." He said, "It's to the largest I've ever spoken to. Now, I'd like a very good speech." You know, said, "Okay, I'll take care of it." So the time came for my colleague to depart, and he rushed into Joe's cubbyhole and said, "You got that speech, Joe?" And Joe said, "Yeah, here it is, boss." He handed it to him. He dashed out and got on the airplane and sat down on the TWA Flight 407, which was on time for a change, and had a scotch and soda and got to talking to the person next to him, and finally didn't get any opportunity to look at the speech, but he wasn't worried. Indeed, he had not looked at the speech until he mounted the dais and placed the speech in front of him on the podium as I have today. And the speech started like this. "Today, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to lay before you a 10-point plan to cure all of the ills of the United States. Not just the foreign ills, but the domestic ills as well. First," he said, "we're going to provide true justice for every Indian in the United States," all the Indians clap. Then he said, "We're going to raise and increase Social Security benefits by 50%, all the people on Social Security. He said, "We're going to provide Thirdly, we're going to provide a free public education for every young man and woman in America, not just through 12 grades, but through 14 grades. Everybody interested in education. He went through 9 of those things, all calculated to get a different segment of the audience. And he then capped it with the 10th one, and he said, finally, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do every one of these things, and we're going to cut taxes by 50%. Wow, the place just demanded. And he realized that by this time that he had everybody in the audience, and he even departed from his prepared text a little, and he said, now you people know that I've never been one to just deal in generalities. I've always been specific with you, and I'm going to be specific today. I'm going to tell you precisely how we're going to do every one of these things. He said, first, and he turned the page, and there in his speechwriter's handwriting were the following words. Okay, cheapskate, now you're on your own. I'm not speaking into the mic directly enough, and you can't hear me in the back, which reminds me of something that happened to me one time. I was speaking, and it appeared to me that they couldn't hear me in the back, and I said, can everyone hear me in the back? And some guy raised his hand back there and said, we can't hear back here. Some fellow right down in front stood up and turned around to him, and he says, I can hear you, and I'll change places with him. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I take this opportunity to address the 30th annual convention of the National Congress of American Indians. You have dedicated your convention very appropriately and its efforts to the goal of restoration of the Menominee tribe to federal recognition and trust status, and have adopted as your theme restoration now. I think it is entirely fitting that this organization, NCAI, meets on the very eve of restoration of the Menominee to celebrate the passage of that legislation in the House of Representatives and to continue your support for the completion of that effort by final enactment into law of this legislation. NCAI was formed in 1944 when the federal policy had just begun to move away from the first era of Indian self-determination, which arose under the Roosevelt administration. I don't think I have to inform any of you that that was a Democratic administration. Toward the disaster and later trauma of the termination era. Indeed, NCAI was formed in part because of the growing awareness among the Indian people that this unhealthy trend in national Indian policy would require a strong, united Indian front to counter it. NCAI grew to maturity in the stormy years of the early 1940s, when termination descended upon the Indian world with a vengeance. The Indian people have not easily forgotten the desperation of those years. The wreckage of that disastrous and ill-fated Indian policy and the language of termination still haunt us today. Phrases such as House Concurrent Resolution 108 and Public Law 280 still have the force and power to cause deep concern and fear among Indian people. By legislative fiat, scores of Indian tribes and groups have been forcibly, though none too successfully, assimilated into the so-called mainstream of American life. When the true magnitude and scope of the catastrophe of termination became apparent to the Indian people, they rose up in strong opposition to its continuance as this nation's Indian policy, and NCAI has been in the forefront of that fight for many years. It was largely due to the efforts of Indian tribes united in the National Congress of American Indians that the often sometimes malicious drug for termination was blunted in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, and is today on the verge of total unqualified repudiation. There are none who can deny that this major shift in national Indian policy represents a major victory for Indian people. But that victory for the Indian people and the aroused national public has not been without its costs. Not costs merely in terms of dollars and cents, but costs in human misery, cultural alienation, and tribal destruction. By the time the active phase of the termination era had run its course, 7 major tribes in Oklahoma, Oregon, Wisconsin, Nebraska, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah, plus scores of small rancherias and Indian communities in Oregon, California, and Utah, had been terminated. As the architect of termination, Senator Watkins, put it, they had, by the grace of God, been made first-class citizens. President Johnson began his message to the Congress on Indian Affairs with a recital of the names of Indian tribes, most of which now only have meaning as postscripts in history books as quaint names of rivers and towns which dot the eastern seaboard. This was the legacy of a much earlier and sometimes bloodier termination policy. Unfortunately, that may well be the legacy of this most recent termination era. Once honored and proud Indian tribes, the Klamath and the Catlamath of Oregon, the Ottawa of Oklahoma, the Catawba of South Carolina, and the Alabama Peshawta of Texas, to be remembered only as postscripts in our children's history books or as the quaint names for rivers and towns dotting the western United States. That, perhaps, is the real tragedy of termination. While we diligently pass laws to save from extinction the wild horses of Nevada and the black-footed ferret of South Dakota, we calmly consign to that same extinction the Menominee of Wisconsin and the Klamath of Oregon. While we piously enact legislation to protect the redwoods of California and the prehistoric ruins at Mesa Verde, California, and Colorado, we knowingly contributed to the destruction of the Paiutes of Utah and the Ottawa of Oklahoma. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong, and indeed I believe in protecting and preserving the plant and wildlife of this nation. But a whole race of